Hello and welcome to the Human Innovation Podcast, the podcast for innovative leaders. I'm your host, Jens Heitland, and today my guest is Brian Gillette. Brian is a long-distance runner and cyclist who has punished himself beyond physical and mental limits in various self-supported tours and races. He accomplished a 205-mile run around Lake Tahoe in 76 and a half hours, with only 90 minutes of sleep. He raced across America with his bike, and his experience in endurance sports have led him to write a book titled Epic Performance, where he interviewed 100 executives and documented what he has learned from them. He also founded Summit Group, a company that coaches executives, advises leaders on performing at higher levels for themselves and their teams. In this episode, we talk about his endurance experiences, what he learned himself from it, but also what he learned from interviewing the 100 executives. Please welcome to the show, Brian Gillette. Hello, Brian. Welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Jens. Thanks for having me on the show.
This was one of the episodes where I was really looking forward to the whole week. And was looking at my training schedule and was like, oh, I'm not really up for this talk. I'm not fit enough for talking to you. Now, really great to have you and looking forward to learn from you when it comes to leadership, obviously. But before we go into leadership, we need to talk sport a little bit. And before we do that, tell us a bit about yourself so that the people understand who you are and where you come from.
I live in California in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I've got two teenage boys, happily married, and grew up in this area, and so love it. As you mentioned, we got to talk about sports. I have, for much of my life, been an ultra-distance athlete, and I remember early on as a kid, I was a kind of a young teenager, I think, and I cycled from my home in the San Francisco Bay Area up to Yosemite, which was 200 miles away. And I did it with my parents. They wanted to go. And that just got me hooked more so into cycling. And then I started to do longer ones, eventually cycled across the United States. Then in the last 10 years, got more involved in running and started to do, you know, it's like, you got to do the marathon. That's kind of the ultimate runs. I mean, you know what it's like.
Yeah.
And then so did the marathon and thought, okay, what's next? And I'm always asking that question, what's next? So did a 50 miler, then a 100 miler, and eventually did the 200 mile run around Lake Tahoe. And I know we'll dig deeper into that one. And one of the things that got me thinking about this stuff is I had people say, oh, I could never do that. And I thought, no, don't hold yourself back. So we can dig into that. I am a former human resources executive, and then about 10 years ago started my own leadership consulting business. And so I, you know, work with executives one-on-one as well as facilitate executive retreats.
Yeah, there are a lot of nuggets in that.
we can dig into them.
Yeah, let's start with running. Do you follow Candice, the race director of Tahoe 200?
I don't follow her regularly. I was for a while, and so apparently you do. Yeah, Candice.
Yeah, she's doing a crazy thing in the moment. She's doing an ultra marathon run streak, 50 kilometers a day. And she's today at day 105. So she has already broken the world record in this, which is epic.
She is a rock star.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a bundle. I met her at the beginning of the Tahoe 200 when she's the race director. She manages a couple of races. And so just a rock star, an amazing woman. So I'll have to follow that a little bit more closely.
It's just so funny. When she crossed the 100 days, she was like, yeah, it was a day like anyone else. And like, yeah, I was a little bit, but yeah, now I go cooking with my kids and then tomorrow is the next day.
you get into, and I'm sure you experienced this when you were training for Ironman, you get into this rhythm where like you start off and you think, oh, running 5 miles is so hard. And then 5 miles becomes, okay, yeah, that's easy. And then it's 10 miles, it's so hard. And then 10 miles becomes so easy. So you know, a lot of people say, oh, I could never run a marathon. And I say, well, you can't run it today.
Yeah, agree.
But you start running a marathon by first running 3 miles and then go and running 4 miles. So you may not be able to do it today, but how do you build up to it for tomorrow?
Yeah. So how did you get into signing up for that race and the craziness? Just thinking about it right now, for me, it's like running 200, is it 205 miles?
It's 205.5, yes.
Yeah. Let us start at this. Like, how was it signing up for this race, knowing that you need to run that?
Growing up in California and loving the mountains, Tahoe is just this iconic, it's just beautiful lake. And I've cycled my bike around it. When you cycle just around it, it's 72 miles. With the run, you're up at elevation. So they create a 200 mile. And after completing kind of the 50 and the 100, I thought I had friends that had done the 200 the year before, the kind of the first year, and I was doing it in the second year, and it just kind of called to me, and it's just like, how cool would it be to say you have run around Lake Tahoe, and you go through the night, it's just this crazy experience, and it's like, all right, I think it would be really cool. So signing up isn't too hard. It's still, it's an expensive race fee. It's comparable to what you would pay to sign up for an Ironman, but signing up's the easier part. But, and I'm a firm believer of, if like somebody will say, okay, what's the first thing I should do if I want to run a marathon? And I tell them, I said, look for one 6 to 9 months out and just sign up for it.
Yeah, agree.
And then let's deal with that, deal with everything else beforehand. So it was just this, it's like, how cool would it be to do it? And it's like, okay, yeah, I've got to try it.
Yeah. And then you got yourself ready for this. How long did you prepare from, let's start with your first marathon to the 200? How much time was in between that?
So I think it was, so I ran my first marathon, and then the next year I did a 50, the next year I did a 100, and then I did the 200. So I think it was about 4 years. September 2015 is when I did the Tahoe 200. Yeah. In November of the year before, I had completed 100. So I was in pretty good shape coming into the beginning of the year, completed the 100. Took about a month and a half off of heavy running, just did some light exercise. And then somewhere in January, I started to ramp up my training. And I had a pretty rigorous training plan that eventually took me to, I had to be able to run 30 miles a day for 4 days in a row. And now you look at what Candace is doing, she's been doing that for over 100 days. But I knew if I could run 30 miles, 4 days in a row, then I was ready, kind of with the physical part. Mental, it's a whole different ball game. Yeah. There's a lot of other things, but it's like, that's the physical shape that I had to get into. And so that was January up until August. The race was in September.
Yeah. Impressive still. but so for everyone who is listening to this, we're geeking out a little bit in this topic today. So sorry for that. If you're not into running or sports, stick to it. It's we're still coming to the leadership stuff.
We'll get to it. I mean, there's a lot of parallels.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'll let you go and we can talk about some of the parallels.
Now, let's go into the preparation, because at least for me, now I'm not that fit anymore, because I have finished my last Ironman, what was it, 2019, directly before the pandemic, and then built my own business. So I have focused a little bit more on that. But one of the things, and I still have my coach, and what I found for myself is, like you said, putting the carrot in front of you, where it's like, there's the race, I need to be ready for that. And I don't want to go, at least for my ambition, is when I go to a race, I want to be fit. I want to be in proper shape. I want to be racing and racing myself. I'm not in a competitive shape to be able to race against anyone, top or age groupers, like it's called in the Ironman or triathlon world. How was it for you? For me, at least, what I understood and learned for myself is the day to day, and specifically the hard days where you're lying in bed and it's like, holy crap, I need to get out running right now. Tell us a bit about that part.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Jens, you say you're not in shape. And my guess, just kind of looking at you, knowing a little bit about you, you're not in shape is probably more in shape than most people's in shape.
That might be.
and so we may have this skewed view of what's not in shape. And I would say the same thing right now. I am not in the physical shape that I was before Tahoe, but I try to stay in decent shape. So how do you get up at 3 a.m. when you don't want to get up? Is that, that's, I think, your question?
Yeah, and specifically, maybe linking that as well to, you have been working as an executive. So it's not like, I have a job where I do 9 to 5 and kind of sit around and can rest in between.
Yeah, you have to really understand why you're doing it. And I interviewed 100 people for the book, and we can talk more about this, but I was talking to one guy who he started up and is running a very successful large engineering business. He was in the middle of training for an Ironman. And I asked him that same question, you know, during my interview, you know, it's how do you get up and do it? And he said, you got to really understand that why and what's important to you. And he goes, my why is, I didn't want to end up dying on the couch like my uncle did from overweight. And what happened is, he went on to tell me the story, is his uncle had hurt his back, was spending a lot of time on the couch, got him heavier. Getting heavier meant him, he spent more time on the couch, and it's just this downward spiral. And he saw what happened to his uncle, and he didn't want that to happen to him. And so he focused on, how do I get in shape? And so at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. when the alarm goes off, that's what he was thinking. Yeah. And on a work side, another one of my clients who oversees a very large organization to try to improve the economic development of a large region in California. And I said, how do you keep going? Because, you know, he's got all sorts of headwinds in his face, and people are saying no, and we can't do that. Mm-hmm. And he said something very similar. He goes, you know, when I was a kid, I saw that when my dad lost his job, he just lost kind of who he was. Yeah. And he lost that drive. And I never want that to happen to people in this community. So it goes back to understanding that why. Now, that's the bigger picture. There's a lot of things of how do you kind of break it down even smaller. One example that when I was training for Tahoe 200, I knew there would be days that I just did not want to get out of bed. And so what I did going into the training, in a sense, I had like about 8 months of training, is I said, I am going to give myself 3 freebies where I can just not train that day. And it's no questions asked. Now, this, you know, if I was injured, that's a different story. These are non-injury days where it's like, I just don't want to get up. I don't want to do anything. I'm going to sit on the couch. And so I had those 3 Bs. So it gave me that out. And so I remember waking up at like 3, 4 a.m. It was raining out, and I thought, this would be a good day to use one. And then what went through my head is, you know, if I get up, the hardest part is getting out and starting going. It's getting from the bed to, you know, 10 feet past the driveway. I thought, if I can get there and just get out and move, I will learn how to deal with the uncomfortableness. And that will be valuable when I'm on trail running. And so I never used any of those 3 freebies, but I always knew I had it in the pack. So it's giving yourself that opportunity to, you know, not be perfect. So, I mean, there's a whole bunch of other things we can talk about. Those are a couple.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I would love to go into what this made to you and what you learned for yourself. But before we go into this, so you're preparing for this race, and then you're in this race. How much of the race is, because they're listeners, most probably 2 or 3, who have never been running 5 kilometers, like 20 minutes run or half an hour run. They can't imagine of running 200 miles. How is it from a physical perspective? But you mentioned already the mental aspect of running 200 miles. How is that? How does it feel?
Physically, it's extremely difficult, and you know, at some point you are going to be painful at all parts of your body. So, but it is, you know, when you run a 5K, and if you've never run a 5K, you get to a point where it's like, oh, I am so sore. And then you get to that point where it's, that happens on a 10K. And so, and a marathon, you know, people talk about the halfway point of a marathon is really about mile 20, mile 22, because that's when, you know, the first 20 miles isn't too bad. It's that last 6.2 that is challenging. And so you're kind of, that's where you think of that halfway point. So physically everything will hurt at some point. You know, I had lost toenails. I had, you know, blisters the size of a quarter on my feet. And so it's hard, but it's not the physical part that stops you. It's up here. And that's in so much of what we do. It's up here that stops us from moving. And it's that ability to keep your mind going. And that's why, you know, when it was raining at, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, I knew that I've got to practice and rehearse when it's hard, because I'm going to need to pull from that when I'm in race day. And I'll tell you, you know, like 50 hours in, it started to rain. And it's like, okay, I had a light windbreaker. I put that on, and it's like, okay, I've done this before. I've run in the rain. I've run when it's dark. I've run when I've been in pain. I can keep going through it. And so it's that mindset that it does push you, and you have to have those tricks of how do you get through it. And you know, I'll share one other. So as I mentioned, you know, one of the things I had to do is I had to run 4 30 mile runs in a row. And so, you know, Saturday get up, run 30, Sunday run 30, Monday 30, Tuesday, Thursday, and 30. And so Monday I'm running 30 miles. And I'm 10 miles into it. So I've already done, you know, 70 miles over the last 2 days, and 10 miles into it. And my legs are tired, and it's hot. It's August in California. It's kind of the hottest time of the, you know, one of the hotter times of the year. And I'm miserable. I'm hot. I'm tired. I'm whining. I'm complaining to myself inside. I'm out by myself. And I thought, a friend of mine had was going through breast cancer. And as I'm whining to myself about how my legs are sore, I started to put things in perspective. And I find this is a great way to kind of look at things, is put it into perspective, is I am voluntarily doing this. I, in about an hour, less than an hour, could be home sitting on a couch, drinking something cold, and my legs in a day or so are not going to hurt anymore. The pain will be gone. She was not voluntarily going through it. Her pain was going to last a lot longer, and she had no choice. And once I started thinking through that, I realized it's like, you know, Brian, you just need to stop whining and kind of move. What you're going through, yeah, it's hard, but you're voluntarily doing it. And so how do you put things in perspective, you know, can help you get through some of those more challenging times.
Yeah, that's powerful. Definitely. So you finished the race. Just give the people listening to it, without anyone understanding the average pace, that all doesn't really matter for these races. But how long did you need to finish the 205 miles?
So you've got 100 hours to do it. And so I had completed it in 76 and a half hours.
That's crazy.
So, you know, in a sense, 3 days. And when I had 90 minutes of sleep, I took about somewhere around, I think 60, 62 hours is when I slept for 90 minutes. So, I mean, you think about it, is I had a full 24 hours that if something went wrong, I could have just slept for 10 hours, gotten up and, you know, gone forward. And to a lot of people, you know, if they bow out early, you know, my sense is, hey, just go to sleep for 8 hours, get a good night's sleep, wake up in the morning and try to see how you're feeling, and then go, but don't quit yet.
That's a good one. For me, it's more, my ambition would be too crazy to say, no, I'm not going to sleep. I can sleep in front of the finish line, but not before.
Well, there's, and you would understand this, is as you're going along, you have to ask yourself, okay, if I DNF did not finish, if I DNF now, what's worse? You know, that kind of the pain I'm going to experience over the next, you know, X number of hours, or seeing DNF next to my name in 3 days.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, ultra distance athletes, you're probably the same kind of look at that. It's like, okay, that DNF is a hard thing to swallow. And so what is it I need to do in order to get off my butt and keep moving forward?
Yeah, especially if you're not injured. I mean, because then it's truly a mental thing. If you're injured, right, it's different ball game, then it's fine. But right, yeah, I agree. For me, I've had the wristband always, like, never give up.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a good point. There is a point where it's safety or prolonged injury will, you know, you have to balance that out. And
yeah.
And when you run that long, when you're out for 76 and a half hours, mentally, you know, I'm not at my best. I was not, you know, my brain wasn't working as well. And so I gave my crew, because I had a pacer, somebody that ran with me for much of the time, not the first 60 miles, but for everything after that. And then I would come into an aid station and I had a crew there. And I had told them beforehand, I said, I will give you guys permission to pull me, because mentally I won't be at a point where I can do that. And so I actually gave it to my crew chief. I said, yeah, you have that responsibility. And if you say, Brian, you can't go on, then I will listen to you. I won't like it. And I might argue about it, but you, at the end of the day, you have sole responsibility to pull me.
Yeah. Let's move towards leadership. What did you learn as a leader, for especially for leading yourself? Let's start with that perspective. And later on, we go into the book when you interviewed 100 executives and what you learned from them. But what did you learn as well from the race across America, which is a fascinating other story, for yourself, on leading yourself?
And early on, I used to, you know, somebody would throw out something big at work. And I was just like, oh, we can't do that. And so I found myself saying that more than my older self does. Hmm. And if I would go back, it's like, okay, that's one thing I'd change. But I realized after doing some of these events that when you say, I can't do that, you're putting such big limits on yourself. And how do you switch that around? Maybe you can't do that today, but how can you get to the point where you could do that? And so it has allowed me to think bigger. I mean, had you asked me 20 years ago, you know, could you run 200 miles? I would have said, yeah, I can't do that. It's like, yeah, no, that's impossible. And there's a quote that I really like. It's, once you stop believing something is impossible, when you stop believing it's impossible, you start believing it's possible.
Yeah.
And it's one thing, you know, I try to get into the people I'm working with. It's definitely one thing I try to get into my kids' head. You know, I have two teenage boys. It's like, you know, when they say, oh, I can't, it's like, okay, well, what do we have to do to get to I can? Or, you know, maybe it's I can't yet. So it's that ability. It really helped me think kind of much broader. It's like, all right, how can we?
And it sounds so simple, but if just working with other organizations, with humans, we are all are limiting ourselves as a first point. It's not that external factors, yes, other people tell us we can't, but in the end, it's, you can decide for yourself. If you want to, you can at least try.
Yeah. And where it really kind of came more crystal clear to me is, so I've done a bunch of 200 mile bike rides, and, you know, a 200 mile bike ride would take me 16 hours or so. And I thought, all right, I want to be able to do 300 miles in one day. So it'd be the first time riding through the night, starting at 5 a.m. I estimated I'd finish about 5 a.m. And my purpose for doing it, and, you know, sounds a little crazy, but is I wanted to understand, how far can I push my mind and my body? And where is that breaking point that I wanted to understand? And so, you know, the first 200 miles part of an organized run, and then an organized ride, and then I just added another 100 miles on. And earlier in the day, I had seen a fellow cyclist dead on the side of the road, and that kind of shook me up. I had collided with another cyclist and needed a new front wheel, and that kind of shook me up. And then I was able to get moving, and somewhere around 2 or 3 in the morning, I had, you know, about 25 miles left. I thought to myself, you know, I never hit the limit of where my mind and my body could go. And that's really when the book kind of started to form, is, you know, we put these limits in our head, and I think they just hold us back.
Yeah.
And so how do we try to get rid of those limits? I mean, there are some limits that are natural. I am not going to be racing in the Tour de France, you know, at my age. So I'm going to focus on other things, but it's that where that line of realistic is probably a little bit further than maybe we give ourselves credit for.
Yeah. But if we just take the Tour de France as the example, you still can cycle the whole course.
I could.
Without a doubt. Yeah. Maybe not in the speed like the professional cyclist.
Yeah.
But you can still do that.
I think that's a great idea. It's like, okay, I'm not going to race a Tour de France, but if it was something I really wanted to do, I could go ride the course.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look at, okay, the average age of a Tour de France winner, the average age of a Tour de France cyclist, and they're in their 20s. I'm in my 50s. Yeah, that ain't going to happen. But to your point, okay, shift things a little bit.
Yeah.
How do you go ride the course and do it a little bit differently? So I that's the type of thinking that, you know, we want to kind of get more people doing.
Yeah. And funnily enough, my coach will cycle the Tour de France course this year.
And
so he's 53, 54.
Yeah.
Cracking it.
I mean, people often, one of the excuses we often use is I'm too old.
Yeah, it's not true at all.
No, I mean, the oldest guy to run a marathon was 100, and he started running marathons when he, I think, was 89. It's like, all right, maybe you're not too old.
Yeah.
So those are the people that inspire me that, okay, when I'm 89, what am I still doing?
Yeah. And I think that's, I love these examples because it just means start. If we take running, you don't need extra gear in the beginning. If you run 20 minutes, you don't even need extra shoes, nothing. Just doing it and getting started is the first step. And then keeping it going, doing something on top of it. It's just what I learned for myself training, and I see it as well when I'm not, like I said, am I not in shape? So now I'm running half an hour, 45 on the weekends, an hour. It's not much compared to before. But still, I feel if I'm not doing it, so when I'm not training for 2 days, my brain is kind of in a mood where my wife is saying, I think you should go out running.
We might have the same wife, because my wife will do the same thing. You know, she'll say, hey, honey, you know, maybe you need to go out for a bike ride or go out for a run. And that's their cue of saying, you're really annoying me.
Exactly.
But I think that point, Jans, that you talk about is just start, is, and that applies to everything. I mean, I was talking to somebody a while back, and they wanted to start their own business. They were fully employed, and they wanted to move into similar to what I do and do some consulting. And I said, what can you do in the next 72 hours that moves you forward? You don't have to quit your job, but what is it? And that's, I mean, think about what you can do in the next 72 hours. It could be researching, it could be buying a domain name, whatever it is. And then do that, and then do it again. Do, you know, what now in the next 72 hours?
Yeah.
You know, it's that whole Christmas song, put one step in front of the other and soon you'll be walking out the door. Just get moving.
Yeah. And that's so funny that you mentioned that, because a lot of people are asking me, how do you do all the things you do from an entrepreneurial perspective with like having two businesses and so on? That's that's just the normal grind I'm used to. And it's not grind in a negative way. It's more, it's just set a goal, get things done, and then set the next goal.
That's probably a good, how do you link sport and business together? I mean, one of the reasons why you are probably successful in your business side is the same reason I would say you're successful in your sport side. And when I interviewed the 100 people, 75% of them were on the work side, CXOs, so founders of companies. And then 25% of them were ultra distance athletes. So minimally, they'd done the equivalent of an Ironman. So done. I talked to two people who ran 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. Huh. And it was not unsurprisingly, I guess, to me, of how many people had done those ultra events that were also very successful at work. It's that same, I think there's that same mentality that exists.
Yeah. Let's talk about the book and how did you start with, hey, I want to interview 100 people. Or did you start out with the goal of interviewing 100 people? How did you get into that?
Yeah, I would like to say that the 100 came because it was a very scientific method. And, but it was pretty much, it's like, all right, I want to talk to 100 people. I think that will give me what I need. Yeah. And so I just kind of threw out the idea of 100. And it was big goal. It would get me a lot of information. It would get me a bunch of stories. And so the 100 was just kind of somewhat random, I'd say. And I started kind of going to my network, and it was surprisingly easy to connect with 100 people.
Yeah.
That's another kind of one of the big lessons that I learned is I was often hesitant to ask people, ask people for help, ask people, for guidance, because, one, it makes me look weak. And but the other thing is I didn't want to hear no. Yeah. And so I was wondering, how many people am I going to have to ask in order to get 100 people to say yes? I only had 2 people say no to me. And one of them was a family thing. It was just not the right time. They were having some issues going on. They said, it's just not the right time. It's like, okay, I get that. And then the other one just didn't want to, I didn't get connected up with her people, which was the challenge, but still, that's not bad. So it's like, if there's something you want, at least ask.
Yeah. And being persistent, which links back to sports as well, doing consistently things, which opens up opportunities. If you're not starting running, you're not going to be, it's not always linked to health, but you're not going to run the marathon. If you are able to do step by step, go out 3 times a week, it will, the opportunity will be there to run a marathon. Same with business. If you do it consistently, yes, you maybe get 5 no's, you get 20 no's, but as more you do it, as more you learn by doing it, and you get more successful with it. And then there will be yes, yes, yes afterwards.
And I often looked at, if you ask 20 people that said no, and 19 said no and 1 said yes, I would focus more on the 19. Like, 19 people said no.
Yeah.
And, it's taken me time to think about, okay, let's focus on the one person that said yes. Let's put our energy there, because you can't expect to hear yes all the time. But you're going to hear no, and you're going to have to deal with that.
Yeah. What was special from a performance perspective? And the book is called Epic Performance. What was special, what you learned? Maybe the things that are not too well known, where everyone would say, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
From the 100.
A couple things is the 100 are very deliberate and focused. Mm-hmm. And so they don't just kind of willy-nilly go into something. They don't let fate drive where they want to go. And I'm of the view, and so many of the people were, that I can control or define where I want my destiny. And some people don't see it that way. But, these people, it's like, they have a vision. They're very clear on what that vision looks like. They may not know how to get there, but they also then have that confidence in order to start going in that direction. And I would dig in. It's like, where does that confidence come from? Because you don't just start off running a marathon. And you know, they said the confidence comes from smaller wins.
Yeah.
So that confidence comes from, you know, going out and running 2 miles and knowing I can do it. And that builds me up to do 3 miles or 4 miles, or, you know, for the executive, is you don't start off being an executive. You start off being a supervisor, or, you know, even another level, and then you get some skills, and then you're a supervisor where you're overseeing, you know, 15 people. And then you work your way up to a manager where you're, you know, maybe it's 30 people, and kind of work your way up. But that confidence comes from success early on. And the other thing is just a tremendous ability to persevere through challenging times. I mean, all of them had some challenging times, whether it was a failed startup, whether it was a divorce, whether it was a death, you know, a getting fired. All of them had something that kind of rocked them. And that ability to know I can make it through this, and it hurts today, but tomorrow it's going to be better. And so I just have to get to tomorrow. And it was fascinating to talk to these 100 people. And I could have kept doing that. It's like, eventually you got to sit down and write a book.
Yeah. The interesting part is, because the in air quotes, negative part, the not successful things, that what people don't see. It's always only, hey, this is the super duper successful executive and everything is brilliant. Everything looks good and shiny and polished. But they would not be where they are if they wouldn't have the bad things, the downturns.
Yeah. I mean, we look at all these people. You know, I live in the heart of the Silicon Valley. And so I see, you know, these companies that, you know, they have grown from nothing to something very quickly. And I was, you know, part of a company that eventually sold for $4 billion. And the founder of the company, he made a lot of money, and he deserves it. And so as I talked to him, and he said, you know, there were days we were worried about payroll. And you don't see that as you talk about. You don't see the days it's like, are we going to have to close our doors? You know, I was a good friend of mine runs an organization that is truly changing the world, and or changing a continent, I should say. And I was talking to her last night, and they lost a big deal. Hmm. And she's nervous, you know, about what's going on. And it's like, you know, you don't see that when the company IPOs, when they sell to a bigger company and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's fascinating, specifically linking that back to endurance sport and as well the commonalities, because yes, people see that you have finished the 200 run, but the whole hardship to get there and finishing it,
yeah,
and enduring the whole thing is, for me, that's the journey is the fascinating part, not just crossing the finish line. At least in my race experiences, the finish line, yeah, is, yeah, a nice thing, but I'm way more into the whole process of signing up and getting ready for it.
And you know, people ask, what's the hardest part about running, you know, a 200 mile run? And I will say it's all the training leading up to it.
Yeah.
Because when you're doing the race, you know, you have 100 hours, and, you know, you're not going to be miserable for those full 100 hours. And you kind of break it down into something people can kind of understand a little more as you look at a marathon. You know, a marathon is going to take you between 4 and 6 hours for a lot of people. And so, you know, in 6, some 7 hours, you are going to be done. No matter what it is, the race director is going to say, off the course, you're out. And but when you train, you've got 4, 5, 6 months that you have to stay focused. You have to deal with pain. You have to deal with misery versus the race, which is 4, 5, 6 hours. And so I always say it's harder to get to the start line than to get to the finish line. If you can get to the start line healed and you did your job, you're going to get to the finish line.
Yeah. Before we go into the last part, tell us a little bit about what you do with your company. You already mentioned a little bit, you help people as well when it comes to leadership, performance, etc. Tell us a little bit about what you do and what are the people or corporations or companies you work with.
Yeah, so in generally, I do two things. I facilitate executive retreats or leadership retreats, and the primary purpose is mainly to get people aligned around where they need to go. You know, most of the issues I hear about, it's because the group doesn't know exactly where we want to be tomorrow. Yeah. And if we can get everybody on a similar page or at least in the same book, you know, your success rate as an organization is going to go up. So I'm you know, pulling people together. I'm working with the executive team to say, all right, where do you want to get to at the end of the day or the 2 days? And then I help them get aligned and move in that direction. Sometimes it's some team building, kind of get everybody to understand more of who they are and more about the team. But generally, it's you get to understand where you want to be.
Yeah.
So that's on the group side. On the individual side, you know, I may work with a director, vice president, and, you know, they're really good at what they do, but maybe they need some guidance or they need some coaching and how to expand in a certain area. You know, maybe they've moved from a director up into a VP, and that's a different job. Yeah. And so how do you understand the differences? What are some of the skills you need to do in order to be successful? And you know, being in the heart of the Silicon Valley, I've been fortunate to work with a bunch of technology companies, but also, you know, I've worked with a couple of like city governments or governments. Mm-hmm. And often what I hear is people's, you go into any industry and they're going to say, oh, our industry, our company, we're so different. And yes, a software company is very different than how a city government is run. But the issues at a leadership, at an alignment, at a communication level, pretty much the same.
Yeah.
So
still all, you know, people.
They're still all people, and managers still, you know, whether their manager in one area versus another, they still, you know, kind of do the same things. Where I often see the difference is the speed in which an organization is moving. That's where I see the biggest one, where you got a startup. You know, I worked with Toyota a couple of years ago, and then I worked with this small startup. Same issues, but the speed in which this startup was moving versus the speed in which Toyota was moving, completely different.
How do you bring the sports background and your endurance experience into this job?
Yeah, it's part of what I talk about is how similar they are. And a lot of people can relate to some sports analogies. You know, some people can't. You know, most people can't relate to a 200-mile run. But, you know, a lot of us have played sports early on. And so I'll bring those examples in and we can talk about that. It also helps to bridge that gap of, you know, how are you thinking bigger? And so if I use some of my examples of, you know, at one point I would have never thought I could do Tahoe 200.
Yeah.
And so how do you try to make it personal for you? And if you can make it personal for you and get better at being able to think better, bigger for yourself, you can then start to do it for people around you. So, you know, when I do talks to different groups, one of the questions that I will ask is I will ask people to think of something really big in their life that they want to do, that they've always dreamed of doing, and get that in your head. And for your audience, you know, I encourage you to do the same thing. Think about that one thing, not something you're going to do this year, but something that's like, I want to do, you know, really big, whatever it is. And then ask yourself, you know, when I'm 80, will I regret not doing this? And if you answer a yes to it, then at least go out and start figuring out what can you do in the next 72 hours to start moving in that direction. Because there was a woman by the name of Bronnie Rare who wrote a book about the top regrets of the dying. And she was a home healthcare nurse. So if you're familiar with the book, and she talked to people who were dying, and One of the things she heard was people often regret the things they didn't do versus the things they did do. We don't regret the things we did do as much as the ones it's like, oh, I wish I would have.
Agree. Yeah, I've heard about it. It's definitely. So last question before we go into the last part. But just between us, we don't have listeners right now.
They've all checked off.
Exactly. Working with a person that's into endurance sport as a client or working with a person that's not at all into sport, what's the difference?
I just have to use different examples. The sports examples wouldn't work as well. So I have to find something that resonates with them of when they've said, I can't do something, you know, whether it's in the theater, whether it's in a musical instrument, is think back to a time when you've said, I can't, and how do we kind of, you know, take the sports out of it. And how do we get to something that's meaningful to them? And, you know, I remember years ago, I was working with a fairly senior executive in a company, oversaw all of the engineering for an organization. And you would look at him and think, tremendously confident, tremendously successful. And he said, and as I was doing some one-on-one work with him, he goes, I get very nervous when I give presentations. And I would have never thought that.
Yeah.
And we all, you know, most of us get nervous in presentations. And I knew he liked to do bagpipes. He was a bagpipe player.
Yeah.
And so we started talking about bagpipes. I said, you know, when you play bagpipes, you know, do you get nervous in front of groups? He goes, no, I don't. I said, you know, why is that? And so we started going down that path. And it because, you know, I know this, how to play it. I practice it. It's like, okay, how do you take that concept and put it into your presentation where you know the material so well, you've practiced it so well, that it's just like playing the bagpipes? So you have to find that thing that resonates with the person.
Yeah, I just imagine when I was working as a fairly high manager in an organization, I would have loved to have you talking about sports. we take this guy.
and you know, it works for some people. Yeah. And some people it doesn't. You know, it would surprise the heck out of me when I did some research. Only 1% of the U.S. population has run a marathon.
I was expecting way more.
I was too, and I was surprised, and I kind of looked at a couple sources, and, you know, it was on the internet, so it's got to be true, but I looked for a couple sources, and it's, either way, it's a really low number, and I thought, you know what, it's probably only 1% that can't run a marathon. I would say 99% probably could.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, why? So it's a low number, but I think more people could do it.
Agree. Let's go into the last part. If not, we're sitting here the next two hours.
And then we won't have any listeners.
Yeah, only the sports people.
That's right.
Okay, first question from the last part. If you could work with a project, either leading it yourself or being part of it, that is impacting every human being on Earth, what project would you decide to work with and why?
I'm not sure if this impacts everyone, but eventually it likely will. And if you asked me this question 2 days ago, I might have had a different answer. But I was just, you know, literally right before you and I got on for our discussion, we were talking about ChatGPT and the impact it is having. And I also teach at a university. I teach a leadership course for the graduate course. And there's a lot of discussion around how ChatGPT or AI is going to impact learning and, you know, do we block it? Do we not block it? And the ethical issues around asking, you know, ChatGPT to write something and then who owns that? And so I think it's fascinating. I think it's going to change our business and I'm excited for where it goes. And so it's something I'm going to have to learn. I want to learn more about, but it would be an area. It's like, yeah, we have to embrace this technology.
Agree. Yeah. Last question from the normal questions. What tips and tricks would you give and advice would you give to a young innovator that's just getting started?
Last night, I went to hear Marley Matlin. I don't know why I'd say speak because she's deaf. And so she signs, and then she had somebody that was speaking on her behalf. She was Academy Award winner, the youngest deaf person at 21. She got an Academy Award. She just released last year, the year before, the movie Coda, which is Children of a Deaf Adult. And so I went to hear her speak or see her speak. I'm not sure. And what she said, and I say this to my kids all the time, is she had a tremendous amount of challenges growing up. And her dad would always sign three letters to her. And I don't know sign language, so I can't do it. But he would say, T-R-Y, try. And I tell that to my younger son a lot. He goes, Dad, I can't do this. I said, just try. Just try it. And maybe you can. So that's the advice I would give to that younger person is just try it. You know, and maybe it'll work. It might not work. And then try it again or try something different. But just try, T-R-Y.
Great one. Where can people find you and how can people reach out to you?
Yeah, no, I always love to hear stories, especially if somebody that's trying to do something big. The best way, so you can go to my website, which is epicperformances.com. So E-P-I-C, performances with an S at the end, .com. And then there's ways to get in touch with me. You can connect up with me on LinkedIn, Brian Gillette, it's B-R-Y-A-N. You can get the book, Epic Performance, Lessons of 100 Executives and Endurance Athletes on Reaching Your Peak. You can get that on Amazon. And so connect up with me and share the stories of something big you're looking to do. And then when you do it, send me, share that because I love to hear those success stories.
Yeah, and I will put the links as well into the show notes. Wherever people are listening or watching this, they can find it and click straight away through you. Brian, thank you very much for being on the show. It was an awesome pleasure to have you and hope to meet you one day for a run. Thank you very much.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Jens.
Thanks.